Okay, I think we'll start with the next part. I'd like to introduce Sam Willits, our poet tonight, now, and Ellie Roberts is going to be the discussant. I'm not going to say very much because Ellie's going to do a brief introduction herself. I just want to mention today we've got two of the new generation of poets from the Poetry Society here today. Sam is one of them, and Emily Berry, who is here somewhere, is the other. And this is a new generation of poetry poets who are seen as being the poets to look at in the future. These lists are difficult, but it's nice to have people on them as well. So, okay, over to you. Yes,
thank you. And we're hoping actually that when we get going with the poems, and we've got quite a few for you to look at, and we're going to project them up here so you can see them, that you might have a chance to participate in thinking about them. Because, you know, you've all been very patient and been listening for a long time this afternoon. So we're going to be looking at some of the poems from New Light for the Old Dark by Sam. And this remarkable collection was shortlisted for the T.S. Eliot Prize in 2010. And it represents a journey, in part your journey, and in part other people's stories. And one of your reviewers referred to it as to the collection as a sort of Bildungsroman, you know, psychological growing up of the protagonist. The poems travel from the imaginative and empathic exploration of your parents' experience and, in part, the catastrophic impact of the Holocaust to your own catastrophe, in some ways, of developing your heroin addiction. And that was at age 37. And onwards, the poems look at your recovery, love, lost love, regrets, and looking forward. You were brought up in North Oxford in an academic home, and your father was a scholar. He's professor of Russian studies.
Professor, yeah.
Okay. We downgraded him or upgraded him? He was at St. Anthony's. Yes. And he translated Solzhenitsyn?
Yes, he did.
And he wrote on Stalin?
Yeah.
So I got that right, good. Yeah.
He met Stalin.
And in fact, you lived probably just opposite his college in near St.
Very close, yeah.
Very close. Yeah. And in some ways, he seems to have been a mysterious figure, but that's only from my own observation in talking to you, because Sam and I have done this before. We've talked about Sam's poetry. Your mother and her family were inside the Warsaw Ghetto, I believe, or?
No. They weren't in the Warsaw Ghetto.
Okay. But, yeah. Closely associated with it.
Well, they...
perhaps we don't have to go into that. But they certainly... Well, we are going to go into it in a different way. but really what I'm trying to draw attention to is the fact that your mother certainly had a history of the Holocaust and the Nazi regime. And your mother survived and seems to have been, since childhood, an amazingly brave woman. And that's illustrated in the first poem you're going to read. And obviously your parents have made this extraordinary journey to the safety of academia and North Oxford life. And in fact, you stayed in Oxford for your university years and read English literature at Wadham College. And then you were doing some writing. And now you're here as a poet. And in planning this afternoon, we used the quote, it was Jerry and I trying to sort of think about what we call this, and it was, we sort of picked up one of Eliot's lines from Bert Norton, Time Present and Time Past. And in that poem, Eliot sees that memory has to be sort of abandoned and that there's this organizing factor in the universe, and although consciousness cannot be bound within time, that as human beings we cannot escape time. And he poetically advocates staying in the moment. Now, Wilfred Bion, who was a psychoanalyst of some note, following on from Melanie Klein, he says that a present experience is past, is present, and is future. It is timeless. And they seem to be dealing with similar themes. In fact, Bion was a major, I think, or in the Royal Tank Regiment, and in fact he wrote, I think it's called Times Remembered?
All My Sins Remembered,
which is, I think, is that the one he wrote when he was a university student?
It's an autobiography of his, yes, of his time. Soon after,
so it's quite sort of different sort of beyond to the beyond we'd read once he was an analyst. Anyway, Anna Dartington, in an essay about Bion and Eliot, says that Eliot regarded creating a poem as mainly an unconscious process which aimed to express and articulate the emotional intensity aroused by thinking about and experiencing the world. This afternoon, perhaps we might add that the poet is also unconsciously articulating transgenerational experiences that find their way up through the mind and the body to express themselves. Some of the themes that we hope to discuss relate to the private and public function of the poem, which we talked about, Sam, which seems also to have a parallel with the title of this conference, obviously, Memory and Memorialization. That is the personal memory and the more social consensus to engage in memorialization. As we are also in the year of thinking about past wars, we are of course presently engaging another war against the Islamic State. It's been a theme which has been coming up today, that of transgenerational transmission of trauma. And it's not such a fanciful idea, in that modern science tells us that genetics actually affect the way we live our lives. That is, our experience affects our genetics, and that affects the next generation. And Sam, we were talking about that too, weren't we? And it came to me that did not Hamlet keep company with the ghost, letting him know about the atrocities of the past? So how those past things infiltrate into our minds in a way which we're not consciously perhaps pursuing, but when you're in a creative process and in touch with the unconscious and with your internal world, there's no way of stopping them coming because they just find their way out. And part of what we were talking about the pleasure of poetry, is that it helps you encounter something that you half know, did know, sort of intuit. So we thought to look at your exploration of the subject of war as a way of beginning to metabolize some of these experiences, your own and your family's and other people's. Some of the poems pictures up in the middle of your own maelstrom, trying to quit heroin. But first of all, let us consider the history that you symbolise in your poems. And I'm just thinking that over to you, really, because we're going to begin.
Yeah, thank you very much. Hello, everyone. Just a couple of thoughts. Perhaps first of all, Ellie's chosen a list of poems.
We did discuss them.
Yeah, okay.
Just, you know.
Well, not just unilaterally.
No.
You suggested, proposed certain poems.
Yes, that's right.
Which is, in a way, good for me in a way, because the second reading I've done just recently where I haven't, you know, been the only chooser of what I'm going to read, and so my kind of, you know, vanity or perfectionism preferences don't necessarily come into this, and I just feel like, no, these are the poems I have to read, and that's probably good for me, in a way.
And you're making me sound absolutely terrible here.
Not at all. I'm saying it's a good thing. And the other thing I was going to say is that when I sat down and read this collection for the first time as a book, sort of, you know, cover to cover, which I didn't do for a very long time, really, after it was published, I have to say I felt that there were too many poems about the Second World War in it. And I was a bit kind of dismayed by that, and thought that if I'd been editing it, and perhaps if I'd been a bit more together during the editing process, because I was still in a bit of a state at that time, that I would have cut one or two or perhaps three of the things. But that's how it is, and in another way, I suppose, I'm glad I've done that. I guess that means now I do hope to move on, I think, from that. I hope to read one poem today that hasn't been published yet, and it might be the last one that I write about those things, to say the Holocaust, the Second World War, my mother's experience, and then perhaps, you know, time to move on. Actually, equally with heroin and addiction, I'd quite like perhaps to write one more good one, if I can, about that, and then perhaps leave that. So, the first poem that we have agreed on to read is On the Smolensk Road. Earlier, I was very struck by this thing of you know, people not talking about their experience, about the experience of war, and I'm sure most of us here, all of us know, that that is a very common thing, that people who've been through these things very often will not talk about them. My mother wouldn't talk about, simply really didn't talk about this stuff. Very occasionally she did, and one thing that stuck me, partly because of its rarity, was the story that this poem is built on, in which she and her mother, who were at that time refugees on foot, running from the Blitzkrieg, from the Germans, along with everybody else, including a lot of military, a lot of soldiers who were top of this huge column of refugees, and they were shot at from the air. And this is, perhaps as good a point as any. I'm conscious that we're all that much time, and you've probably had quite a very full day, to say that the question of sort of, you know, inherited trauma, I don't know how best to describe it. There is a very interesting book I recommend called Waking the Tiger. I found it very interesting, which written by an American doctor, a medical doctor, which is about I hope I'm getting this right, really, about the pathogenic potential of trauma, not only, you know, for the individual experiencing it, but perhaps for future generations. I think it's very interesting, for example, that the BRCA1 gene mistake, which I carry, actually, which only occurs in Ashkenazi Jews. It's very, very bad if you're a woman. Both my sisters have it. They've both had major surgery. My mother died of breast cancer. Women who have it have an 80% probability of developing breast cancer with BRCA1. Not quite so bad news for men. It's dangerous. It's not great, but it's not nearly as dangerous. That's something that quite interests me. I don't know, but... So, this poem, On the Smolensk Road, is about my mother's experience. The Stukas, finished with the men and tanks, turned back for the civilians. The mile after mile of refugees, scuffing and trundling behind the Russian retreat and bottlenecked before a bridge over the Dnieper. The cocked gull wings were sighted, a panic warning yelled along the line, and everybody ran, cowering, hands on heads, into the roadside fields. One woman hit the ground, pulled down her small daughter, who was my mother, and whose guiltiest memory it became. She saw at once that her mother's flowered dress might make a target, so she tried to kick, gouge, claw, thrash herself free from the arms, struggling to cover her from the planes, to bulletproof her with love. My mother said there was no describing the insane scream of the Stukas dive. Was his blood screaming too, with speed and schnapps, with young survival would trigger happiness, until he felt like a young sun firing out of the sun. Perhaps through his cockpit's panes he glimpsed some brightness moving in a small heap below, a girl howling like a divok in her mother's pinioning arms, or something like a blown flower out there on the earth as it tilted, as the river and field and the roads, small and many human spillage, pivoted away. that's my attempt to, the word empathic also sort of caught my ear earlier, in here. My attempt to, you know, to inhabit that experience, to share it, and I suppose, you know, to having speculated, because it's all, of course, conjecture, all this, you know, on my part, about my mother's and her mother's experience of that incident. I wondered about the pilot shooting at them, what that felt like, and how exciting perhaps that would be, you know, to have that power, essentially to be a flying sports car with machine guns and cannon, and a young man. I mean, very exciting thing and powerful thing, I guess, to do. At the same time, for my mother, as a little girl, being shot at, so a strange thing. And
yes, and quite. And I think when we read the next one, perhaps we can, because in the next poem, A Moral Defeat, it's very much more your experience. So this first poem, it, as you say, it's a sort of conjecture about trying to get in the shoes of your mother and her mother. And gives us this very sort of vivid picture. I mean, a picture which we see the news today, where we're going to see the same fleeing of people away from horror.
Yeah.
And yet in this next poem, A Moral Defeat, it's very much more, I mean, we're missing out. You want to miss out a few, which is, you know, we're going to do next, A Small Girl in the Crowd, sorry.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Which is another one like this one, where it's a conjecture, isn't it, about...
Yeah. Yeah. And this is one that, I mean, I'm very happy reading it. I'm on the chosen it myself, so it's good for me. No, it's good to do this. Right, Small Girl in the Crowd. This is pure, yes, more speculation. Her mother's scratchy, cooking-scented pleats brush against her cheek as she hopscotches from cobble to curb in time with a lynx-rex crunch. All around her, half intimidating, half protective, is an adult mass of overcoats and furs, tobacco smoke, cologne. Her sightline is level with the scissoring X of breeches and jackboots, the human machine hinge. She senses the stirring certainty and arrogance of those heels hacking down, watches the steel carapaces flow past, shining dully like wet cobblestones, senses her mother's fear and scorn. She steps out from the crowd again, and her mother yanks her back by the hand, so hard the wedding ring pinches. Looking up, eyes narrowed in reproach, she sees her mother's gaze is far beyond her reach.
Yeah. I mean, you know, please comment from the floor. One of the things that came to my mind is the way that certainly as children we want to know about the interiority of the mother. We want to know about the sort of person she is. And the baby's very good at sort of exploring that, not only sort of physically, but mentally, you know. And these poems seem to be, these particular poems seem to me a way of trying to sort of explore who these people are, really, in the context, you know, this huge historical context.
Yeah, I mean, I was just thinking, if anyone does have anything to ask, I'll say, I'll shut up. I don't think anyone does at this point. Yes, sorry.
Yes.
It was to some extent from objects, because I just remember my grandmother, her mother, and I remember sort of scent on fur collars and that sort of thing, and dusty scent bottles, and I remember the physical, some of the physical, the things, you know, around her mother, that did come from another world in a way, I think, and she smoked heavily. Her father sort of apparently taught her to smoke when they were reunited by accident after the war. They were accidentally reunited, having been separated. So no, it is absolutely speculative, the incident. As I was reading that, I was thinking about, in a way, about that, that it's so concrete and trying to be very, very vivid and very sort of concrete. And I think that perhaps that's, you know, I do worry, I guess, about the legitimacy of this exercise, and especially with something so emotive and so open to, perhaps, to victimhood. Now, you know, it didn't happen to me. And that phrase became almost a sort of unhappy mantra for me. It didn't happen to me. And there is, I have had a sort of guilt, I guess, quite simply, about what can sometimes feel to me like I'm appropriating something that I'm not entitled to. And it's something very emotive and very powerful. It didn't happen to me. And so is that, you know, is there something narcissistic about that? Is there something, self kind of aggrandizing, self-romanticizing, poor me, and so on. And maybe one way of validating, of legitimizing the exercise is just to try to make the poem strong and real and vivid, and then, you know, just by that, in that simple way, to sort of redeem the thing, just make something of value that I can say, well, at least I've done this with it. You know, so it's not purely self-indulgent, at least I'm trying to give something as well and to communicate it, you know. And I think that's perhaps what the sort of the very physical and concrete thing is rooted in. I want it to be real in a way, I guess, and if that makes sense. And that's why, I mean, moving on, there are some poems coming, just a couple, where it moves to my experience. And again, just in the last few minutes, I'm sitting here sort of thinking about what I've written. I haven't looked at that point, for example, for quite a long time, a couple of years probably. And so I'm looking at it, not pressurized, but, and, you know, it strikes me that, I've written about the inadequacy of my response to these things, actually, to this history. And, there's a poem in this collection called Jewish Section, which is about going to my mother's grave. My mother, by the way, died, she was 49 when she died, and in this whole issue of sort of trauma and damage, I mean, she was physically as well as mentally very badly damaged, you know, by malnutrition as a little girl during the war, by the whole experience. I mean, she was traumatized and she was physically damaged by it, and she died young. So in that sense, there were times when I would even think, you know, they got her in the end, which is a kind of a self-indulgent thing to think, but I didn't think that at times, you know. It took 49 years, but they got her, you know.
But so in that sense, it is your experience, isn't it? Because I know that you wish to deny the sort of, you know, appropriating it, but it is your experience, and I think that's the...
To me, it's very, it's quite dangerous, there's an ambiguity about mine and not mine in this you know, my mother and me. Of course it is, she's my mother, but is there a line beyond which this is my question. So that poem about the cemetery, in that, I go there, well, I can't engage with it, I can't respond adequately. And I get the sort of funeral syndrome where I'm thinking obscene thoughts, sexual thoughts, mad.
Should we read it? Jewish Cemetery,
okay.
You're referring to,
aren't
you? Yeah. The Jewish section.
Because I can't write it. I'll just
it's further down.
Yeah. Yeah. And so these poems are like a moral defeat. I went to Poland, just briefly, I went to Poland for 2 weeks to try to find out what happened to my mother's family. Because she didn't talk about it, it was hopeless. I got more and more upset and confused, and I met some very scary anti-Semites. It was very spooky. I ended up quite close to Auschwitz. I didn't go there. My mother wasn't there, by the way. And I just cracked up, really. I came back 2 days early in a very bad way. And as it happens, I absolutely do not blame or attribute my addiction, my Arab addiction, to that. I want to make that clear. However, it was shortly after coming back from that trip that I picked up heroin full time. And I'd used heroin on and off for 17 years before that. And I was never going to be a junkie. It was something I did very occasionally. I knew that 3 days you were going to have a habit, put it down. So I always did. When I came back from there, I was really in bits. And as it happens, that is when I picked it up. Yeah.
So in that case, as you've referred to moral defeat, should we do that one? Because chronologically, yeah, a bit more sort of ordered.
Sure.
Page 40, I think.
Thank you.
Page 44.
Yeah. So, yeah, this is a subtitle of the Żydowski Cemetery in Warsaw. It's a very neglected, overgrown cemetery, which is a bit of a good secret. They don't, it's sort of the elephant, and if you forgive the cliche, in the middle of Warsaw, huge, you know, it was then anyway. Being taken the long way, the mug's way, back in a minicab, those cheery signs in Krakow, Auschwitz taxi, best race. I stared at the bristles of the driver's neck, too tired after 10 days of fruitless searching to argue with those stolid rolls of fat. Some nerve was paradiddling in my ears. I recognized it from bullied school days' imminent tearfulness. Through the orange rain reunions down the taxi's window, I went on seeing the Żydowski's evergreen jungle darkness, the matted cut flowers and flooding candle stumps that spoke of visits by righteous Gentiles. The unbearable wall, privately built, no state money for this, of children's faces, snapshots varnished safe from defacers. I came to these places to find how sense could be made of it all and found it couldn't. Somehow, I got as far as the hotel lobby and a brown leatherette bonquette before my detonation, screaming, snotting, gasping, sometimes nearly laughing, grateful to be ignored. As soon as I was able, called another best rates taxi to the airport to find the soonest flight away. So, that's what happened. And, you know, it was a defeat in two ways, really. A sort of practical failure because I wasn't able to find out stuff, and I went to archives and various places and met interesting people, but I didn't find out what happened. And so that was the... And also I ran away. I copped out, I crapped out, I ran away. And went back, came back here and got loaded to sort of kill it, I suppose. And, yeah, and also, the reason I was there was I was commissioned to write two articles for American Airlines In-Flight Magazine. Or, you know, the thing that people read in absolute desperation, if they read it at all. But I thought, great, okay, they're paying for me to go there, I'll use this. I'll find out what happened, you know. And so I also felt a bit that I was doing this sort of cynical, crappy job at the same time. Very confusing.
Sorry, Sam, you talk about inadequate responses. There are so many that are so momentous that that's the only response that's appropriate, I think.
Yes. For me, yes. I suppose it's the feeling that I should respond adequately, and also because then, you know, I'm writing a poem about it, I'm sort of using it. It becomes quite complicated to me, quite complicated and confusing. I'm sort of using it in a public performance, after all, you know. And the potential for me, there's a certain guilt in that. What am I using this for? What's my motive? You know. I hope it is legitimate, really. I have to hope it is. You know? And something in me needs to do it. So I guess, you know, it has to be.
Right.
I was just thinking about the motivation behind this attempt to understand is kind of key, isn't it? So it's the motivation of intruding into someone else's experiences to try to understand. That has to be more benign, in intent at least, than any other motivation, such as to control or to manipulate. Mm. But it will still feel as if it carries that risk of intrusion.
And, you know, Beyond said keep close to the firing line when talking about the imagination, the pain that you have to encounter, you know. But maybe this firing line is really, as you say, just too difficult to keep close to.
The guilty sort of self-beating up part of me, I guess, says in a horrible kind of sinister whisper, says, maybe it's easy, maybe it's just the easy thing to do to write about. You know, this book's very mother heavy, actually, because my father wasn't Jewish. My father wasn't Jewish. I'm only Jewish, technically, according to...
I was just going to say that you lost your mother at
a young age, so I'm just... It seems to me that far from appropriating her life in order to have a small subject for a poetry manager, you're doing what the other poets today seem to have done, which is to be memorialising a direct ancestor, whether that direct ancestor was reading their bloodline or symbolically so. Mm. And that's how reading those poems comes across.
Yeah.
You're exploring your mother's life and how it felt to be a child to get close to her.
That's what I hope. That's what I have to hope, I suppose, yeah.
Yes.
Well, this is a more kind of familiar and domestic way of looking at it, but the poem about your mother trying to cover her mother's body actually seems to me very movingly your protection, and that was how I experienced it as you looking after your childhood mother. And I think that there's quite a strong sense amongst our parents' generation who in different ways had very, very difficult experiences with war, that they have to give birth to themselves and reparent themselves because they lost so much of a sense of continuity. And as their children, I think they spend quite a lot of time trying to protect them and give birth back to them. And that was at least my experience of the kind of thing that I experienced.
It's a lovely way of putting it, isn't it?
Yes, that's very interesting because I was in a rehab. And it was a very good one, actually. I've been in two, and this one was very, very good. And I was having some psychotherapy there, really. And the psychotherapist there, and actually there's a poem, I hope it's time I quite like to read, which came out of those sessions, actually. The psychotherapist said, at one point I was talking to her about... Or she was sort of putting it to me and challenging me about my irresponsibility and sort of not really engaging with the world in a responsible adult way and so on. And that poem came up. I actually showed her this poem and she said something very interesting to me about my mother's sort of overprotectiveness and my failure in a way that my mother sort of did this to me, you know, as when I was a child in what actually was not a healthy way and didn't enable me to have, you know, healthy boundaries and so on, and be sort of self, I guess, you know, pretty sure I'm getting that. It stunted and distorted my growth, I think, in a way, inevitably. But I also, it's understandable that she was kind of doing this in rather a crazy way, not in an effective way, and not even in a way that seemed loving, quite sometimes. It could just seem angry and scary and crazy, you know, but that's what it was about, I think.
Yes.
First, I was very aware that you seem to have no sense of entitlement over your own family history. And now I'm thinking, well, with that particular family history, it's not something one would want to embrace. And there's that dilemma when you have everyone's experience, but so when you have that kind of background, it's particularly on it because people wanted that.
Yes.
I come from a similar background, and those stories, not just in my own family, but in families I know, are used as a way almost of controlling the way some of us think. So I remember my mother saying, "You can't say that to her. She's got a tattoo on her arm." So somebody who had views on Israel was entitled to views that I wasn't entitled to because I didn't have a tattoo on my arm. And I've seen this almost vetoing power of thought used to our generation in a way that I feel very uncomfortable with. And, you know, in a sense you have to give yourself permission to think what you think and feel what you feel.
I certainly feel acutely uncomfortable if anyone invokes the Holocaust to justify the excesses of Israeli. Obviously, you know, that is... I just want to withdraw from that whole thing today.
I just wanted to comment. I was quite struck what you said about you felt your mother was embracing you. You know, that embracing you in this wrong way, that felt like an angry way. And I thought, perhaps she's trying to not embrace you, but embrace herself with her anger at what happened to her, and couldn't even go to see what you needed, and that you were living in the peacetime, and that there was a separation between her child and your child.
I mean, I feel slightly a little bit bad saying it in a way, but my mother was not, couldn't be, a sort of healthily nurturing mother. She just couldn't do it. It was never going to happen. And as it happened, I was really bad for other reasons, but, you know, poor me. But, you know, she really couldn't do that. And I think she was certainly very angry. You know, there was a very frightening anger in her, which was also quite private, because she was sort of very popular, gregarious, very funny, very clever, you know, and had a lot of charm, and a million friends, and was fun, and a bit crazy, and reckless, and stuff. But privately, she was bloody funny. She did very funny. Some things that my sisters tell me things that happened, I don't even remember them. You know, I mean, about her driving us all towards a wall in the car, very fast, you know, I'm going to kill us all. And us all screaming, and then she slams on the brakes, and we all pitch forward, and, you know, and I completely buried that one. Very angry.
I mean, that's you and your mum, isn't it? And in this one, but it's you having your own thoughts, which are very separate. Do you want to go on to something else?
No, I'm just, are we right for time?
We're fine for the moment.
5, yeah.
5:10,
right.
So we've got time.
Oh, right,
but,
yeah,
and we're nearly at the end of the list.
Yeah. I will read this one, since this is what we're on, and I hope that's okay with everyone. I'll read it, yeah. This is about, it's called Jewish Section. Alive, my mother brought me here more often, perhaps meaning to show me how grief can find some shape in duty. We hefted slopping cans from the green tap by the chapel. On a cold day, the wind and the massing trees conferred as we stood at the grave's foot, my hands arranged in marriage behind my back, my breath drifting in life-conscious tribute like the boom of silent gun salutes. Her mother's grave then, now hers too, and always a cenotaph. Its black gloss golden lettered in English, Polish, Hebrew, for the majority of her family whose ashes fell on woods of pine and birch, or who were turned with all those terrible others, naked and resistless, into Polish earth. Whatever the lesson of those visits, it didn't take. Wisdom stays away from here. Acceptance stays away, backed off somewhere behind the wet civic privets and the ewes. I stay away. The Jews in the ewes, forgive me. In that poem, it's funny, as I read it, there's a couple of lines in it, and I was conscious of other poets in the room, particularly because, well, there's a couple of lines that I think are trying quite hard, and they don't quite work, like they fail, for me, in a way, although I know what they're trying to do. And one of them is this thing about life conscious. Now, what I was trying to say was,
Do you want to read the line again?
My breath drifting in life conscious tribute. To me, that's awful. I'll change that if I could. But anyway, what I'm trying to say is just, I'm aware of being alive. She's dead. I'm alive. And the tribute is actually, it's this kind of sarcasm. There's a sort of irony there, actually, meant to be. It's a bit sardonic. That's what I'm looking for. And I'm there blowing steam because I'm breathing. I'm alive. And it's trying to do an awful lot of this poem. I don't know whether it, I can't say whether it succeeds or not.
But it has got that sort of combination of what we're looking at today, which is the sort of memory, and there you are at the cenotaph, as it were, and the memorialization too. But,
yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
What sort of things you thought?
I can move it sort of fairly smoothly from that in a way, because, I mean, I have. I said hoping to move on from, I don't want to stay stuck forever. writing about the same stuff, and there's a lot more to life and so on. So, but okay, this ties it up in a way quite neatly. This came out of the psychotherapy that I had in that rehab in Somerset. This story was told to me by that therapist, and it just had a very, very big effect on me. So this is not my family now. This is, again, this is a kind of speculation. This is a story, as it was told to me. It's quite plain, really. So I think it hasn't been published. It's just like scribbled like that. I think it's called A True Story. Happened in the 1970s, this story. I know a secret, said the little girl, alone with a grown-up lady visitor. My daddy said, never tell anyone. You mustn't tell him. She made her eyes round and important. She took the lady's hand, led her into the empty garden down the path. It's in there, said the girl, and the woman knew that she meant the shed, standing, waiting, at the end of the path. The woman felt something like a pressure drop, a change in the light. Her heart was beating hard, her mind filled with wrongnesses. Webs of rottenness. She knew that in another time the girl's father had been a prisoner behind electrified wire, dressed in thick clownish stripes, starved and brutalized. But no excuse, she thought, no excuses. They reached the door. The girl dragged it open. The girl made another shh, then hopped nimbly up onto a low shelf and with practiced action pulled back one slat and then another. The woman looked into that cavity and understood suddenly, even before the girl spoke again, saying, with an owner's pride, if they come again, this is my hiding place. So, that just really hit me.
Hard to kind of metabolise it, isn't it?
Well, it hit me very hard because of the this expectation, you know, that the father's abusing the girl, and it seems that kind of twist. It just really hit me hard, and the sort of innocence of it. You know. I suppose, you know, perhaps it struck me because it's a poem about a child's not understanding, not kind of responding. So that's it, that's my on what I suppose, if you'll excuse that.
Well, we could read Garden.
I mean, yeah.
If you want to do au revoir. Oh, yes.
I meant that's me on that subject.
All right.
Yeah, there aren't, I mean, we're nearly there anyway, aren't we?
Well, we're going to finish at 5, did you say? We've got it wrong, so it's 5.
Got time.
Yeah.
Do you want to say something?
I just want to say how movingly you can express the child's position. It just reminds me of that film Alexander, long, long time ago.
Honey Alexander.
It was from a child's point of view. And that's so good, thank you.
We've got 2.5 minutes, okay? Is that okay with everyone? You're not just all... I'll tell you why, because my poems aren't very long, and I want to, one, the garden, it takes about 10 seconds to read, so, but there's just one, not long. I want to read it because it's actually for my dad, and I just want to address the bounce, just.
Oh, yes.
And this room reminds me a bit of his study. I was thinking of him in here, so, I
put a trick.
Yeah.
Going to trick.
Just to, so trick, yeah. Okay. The unexceptional mystery takes place. Around 11, love turns to matter, dad, dead. The ward grows and shrinks, early spring breaking promises through the glass. Dyad's untoothed mouth warps, and its last O holds one darkness, dark of a worked-out, abandoned mind. His absence is brute absurdity, his hand soft as vellum. His new state exposes the stark child of him and unsons me. No answers now to his son's questions about this, about the sense, for all his slightness of a long life's mass coming to rest, a settling that churns up grief in a rounding cloud. Dad, dead. End the opaque trick that turns our gold to lead. I'm a little bit worried that when, very, very quickly and briefly, just to tell you that when a poem of mine was read on the Today programme, when the T.S. Eliot shortlist, it's that poem actually, it was me reading it, and I think it was John Humphreys, I've never forgiven him for this, and never will, who said at the end of it, well, that was Sam Cheerful Willits. And, as I was reading that, just then,
he must have been in such distress himself.
Well, you know, the trouble is, just reading that one just then, I'm thinking, as I go home now on the train, I might be a little bit worried that people here, I might have given the impression of being a very gloomy bastard, but there is more to me than this sort of always awfulness. You know, honest.
Of course there is.
Isn't there a sort of joke in the Dad Dead is quite funny?
Yeah. That's fine, yeah. Time, not all the time, but now I can see. So this one's called Garden. A bit more upbeat.
Yeah.
A little bit. And it's the last one I'm going to read. Look to your life, rest your kindness and your unkindness now. Listen. I know what makes your heart clench coldly in all weathers. I know how it feels that it always will. Bear that. Look to your life, to your one given garden.
Oh, that's it.